let me introduce you.
Richard Quint has been a professor of pediatrics at UCSF for a number of years, and he's been going to Cuba since 1978. Richard?
Yes.
He's been going to Cuba since 1978, studying the healthcare system in Cuba. And so he's a wonderful activist within our group here and with the California Physicians Alliance and Physicians for National Health Care, Physicians for National Health Program. So he's
on, but here we are. Okay.
That wall over there.
Now there's one that, there you go.
So when I ask you to, just push that down button. Just like that. So first of all, let me say we have a little bit of time constraint because we're using Bill's computer and he needs to be out of here by 3:40. So I'm going to try to bridge this talk to about 30 minutes. This is, and as Don said, I'm a retired pediatrician from UCSF. I've also practiced in the community setting in North Oakland, and I'm very happy to see two of my colleagues from Oakland sister cities, Santiago de Cuba, the group with which I made my last visit, from which we returned a couple of weeks ago, as well as Joan Intrator, who I had the pleasure of working with 10 to 15 years ago when we started sending medical journals, recycled medical journals and books to hospitals and libraries in Cuba. What I'd like to do is going to be kind of nerdy or geeky or academic because I want to give you an overview of the Cuban healthcare system shown through the lens of the care of kids, because as a pediatrician, that's has been my career and my love. But I think I can outline the history of the development of the Cuban healthcare system since the revolution in 1959 and portray for you how it has made advances in the society as a whole and in particular for children. Why don't you just skip the scenic views and go ahead to the next slide and go ahead. Okay, so I'll give you a brief historical background, focus a bit on Cuba's, the health of Cuba's children, and depending on our time, maybe talk a little bit about the effects of the U.S. embargo, but I'm going to abridge the talk mostly from that aspect, because I think most of you in the audience are very well versed in or knowledgeable about Cuba and the history of the U.S. relations with the island. So could you go to the next slide? A very brief chronology. Prior to 1959, when the Cuban Revolution was victorious, Cuba was first a colony of Spain, and then after the so-called Spanish-American War, became a colony essentially of the United States and endured a multitude of dictatorships. And beginning in 1953, actually there was a long history of resistance to colonialism as well as to the dictatorships on the island. And beginning in 1953, a revolution began and culminated in 1959, led by Fidel and Raúl Castro, Che Guevara, Camilo Cienfuegos, and tons of men and women who led to the overthrow of the Batista government. And in 1960, as part of the new government, the government promised to change the system and really develop a system that would be for the people and improve the general health and welfare of the entire population of the island. So they began a land reform and health system changes beginning in 1960. And in 1961, they initiated the literacy campaign where school children, some as young as 14 years old, went out into the mountains, into the countryside, and began educating, teaching the ABCs to the peasant, the campesino population of Cuba. This was a very risky proposition because the counter-revolutionary activity was beginning in the island, and we all know about the Playa Girón, or Bay of Pigs invasion, which occurred in 1961, which was a failed CIA attempt to bring a stronghold of soldiers onto the island and to initiate an insurrection. It was defeated within 3 or 5 days. Shortly after 1961, the relations with the United States deteriorated even more, and a trade embargo or a blockade was put in place. And this has been in place ever since 1962 and affects the economy of the island quite significantly.
Maybe you could speak a little bit louder.
Can't hear me in the back? Okay. Then is this better? Okay. So Cuba moved into the socialist bloc because they were unable to develop relations satisfactorily with the United States and began a whole host of programs where nationalization of land and factories and the healthcare system began. And Cuba was part of the Soviet bloc until 1989 when it dissolved, and Cuba was left pretty much desperate without any resources for trade as well as petroleum, which was a significant problem. And they entered what was called the special period, which lasted, it actually is probably still going on today, but its effects are not as nearly as severe as they were in the worst years of 1989 to 1994 and 1995. And Cuba had to, in order to purchase oil, they were left with 80% of their oil resources disappeared when the Soviet bloc fell. And Cuba could only get oil on the spot market, and they had to pay in dollars. So they made a very significant decision, an economic decision, where they pegged their economy to the dollar because they had to get dollars in order to pay for oil, and also made a conscious decision to promote tourism in a much greater fashion than they had been in the previous years. There's a lot of issues surrounding this kind of dual economy that we won't have time to talk about now, but suffice it to say that they are now off this dollar system and are pegged more to the euros in terms of the currency as well as the Cuban pesos. But during this period of the special era, the United States tightened the embargo through various pieces of legislation, which made it much more difficult for any kind of trade to occur and for travel to be much more tightly restricted and for families to visit or to send money back to their Cuban relatives from the U.S. Things seemed to loosen a little bit when the Elian Gonzalez affair occurred. You may remember this, where this six-year-old child was rescued from a raft where most of the people had died, including his mother. And he was virtually kidnapped by the Cuban-American community and held hostage, even though his father was his parent, and rightfully asserted his rights to have him returned. And it took the intervention of the Department of Justice under Janet Reno to extricate him from the from Miami. But that opened the door and shed a lot of light on the idiocy and the antics and shenanigans of the Cuban-American nationals in the United States, who have been very rabid and rigid against anything having to do with Cuba and the progress that it has made. Unfortunately, things didn't go so well after that, and particularly under the Bush administration's travel restrictions have been tightened even more, although there are some trade agreements going on where agricultural supplies and medicines can be sold to Cuba under very tight restrictions. It's a very, very fast rundown on the history of where of Cuban history from the revolution to now. Could you go to the next slide? Go ahead.
I pressed it. It's not going.
Press
yet.
Again. Okay. So let's focus on health. Prior to 1959, Cuba was like any other underdeveloped nation in the so-called Third World. It suffered an infant mortality of over 50 per 1,000 live births. The infant mortality, for those of you who aren't in the healthcare field, is a very key health indicator, or a very key indicator of the health overall of any country. So in this pre-1959, pre-revolutionary period, infant mortality was quite high. Maternal mortality was 125 per 100,000 women per year. That's pregnant women per year. In contrast to that, in the U.S., maternal mortality was probably less than a quarter to a third of that number in 1959. Life expectancy in 1960, however, was quite high, which is interesting. It was comparable to the United States, which was a little over 65 years in 1960. Cuba has always had a very high literacy and cultural educational kind of society. And some of the thinking has been that that has contributed to the long life expectancy among Cubans. But the medical system was focused in urban centers and was private in general. So that there were public hospitals, but they were the sickest of the sick and the worst of the care was delivered. People who could afford it paid for their care in private clinics and hospitals, focused mainly in Santiago de Cuba and Havana. The overall nutrition of the society, which still was a pretty much campesino population, was quite poor. So diseases of nutrition and infection were very high, such as childhood diarrhea, respiratory diseases, influenza, bacterial infections associated with non-potable water, and tuberculosis and other communicable diseases. And the clean water was available to only 35% of the population at that time. Why don't you go to the next slide. After 1959, after the triumph of the revolution, they wrote into the Constitution these major organizational principles which have dictated all of their healthcare decisions. First of all, that the people's that health is the people's right and the responsibility of the state. That healthcare must be integrating preventative and curative services. And as Bill mentioned, over the past few years, they're integrating all kinds of curative and preventative services such as acupuncture, homeopathy, herbal medicine. All healthcare is universal, must be accessible to everyone and free. And it must be coordinated with social services and the socioeconomic development of the society. And also that popular participation in the healthcare system is fundamental. The last point has been realized with the active participation of various social agencies throughout the country, the so-called Committees for the Defense of the Revolution, and the Federation of Cuban Women. And each of these organizations have local and regional groups. And within those groups, there are people whose responsibility is to focus on the health care of people within their region. For example, to make sure that pregnant women get their adequate nutrition, make their physician visits, go to the doc, make sure that they are aware of the signs of delivery, and that they're eating the right food, and that their families are being taken care of. Could you go to the next slide? This is the kind of most uninteresting looking slide, but really is a key, in my opinion, to the success of any healthcare system in the world, but particularly for Cuba, because it really is applying basic public health principles to the coordination, the establishment, and the delivery of services. So on the left side are what are called non-medical determinants of health. This is public health jargon for such things that we intuitively understand, but we don't necessarily think about as being contributors to the overall health of a nation. Adequate education levels for people, adequate housing for the entire population, adequate sanitation, clean air, adequate nutrition, and full employment. It's a no-brainer, but it really is a significant public health principle. On the right side, the health service determinants that create or contribute to a successful healthcare system are its accessibility, its universality, its comprehensiveness, its overall quality, and what's called horizontal integration, meaning that nursing services and psychological services, social services, as well as specialty and primary care services are integrated in a kind of a lateral fashion, not a top-down fashion. That's somewhat of a distinction in terms of some of the organization of the health facilities themselves are in a vertically integrated system, i.e. there are clinics at the neighborhood level, polyclinics at the neighborhood regional level, hospitals at the regional level, hospitals at the provincial level, and then national hospitals or centers in other cities such as Santiago and Havana. The focus needs to be on primary care. That's a significant distinction between the healthcare system in Cuba and any other rational healthcare system in the world and the United States. Our system for primary care, the infrastructure is very weak, and we tend to focus on specialty care. And that there must be a promotion of health that is the focus of the healthcare system. That is definitely not the case in the United States, but we're starting to see more talk about it, but in splintered areas like smoking cessation, the obesity epidemic, the reduction of diabetes or prevention of diabetes, and trying to prevent heart disease. But it's done in a very piecemeal fashion. Through these block organizations and regional organizations I mentioned, primary health promotion is focused at the very local level. And then there are the social mediators that contribute to a successful healthcare system, or that there's a strong sense of social cohesiveness, and that's what Bill mentioned, it's the notion of we in Cuba. Everybody's in this together, and it's the social good that is the prevailing wisdom, that we're all going to pay now and assure that we're going to be taken care of throughout our lifetimes, but particularly when we're old. And also significant, one that we didn't necessarily think about, is that the income disparities in a society contribute to the overall quality of a healthcare system. Our disparities in income in the United States are so vast, it contributes to the system where people who have the most money can pay for private care and stand in the front of the line, to get their specialty visits, their clinic visits, their surgeries, whereas the poor are left at the bottom. The income disparities in a society like Cuba are much narrower, and the overall distribution and spending of money on health care is much more evenly dispersed. The United States spends over $7,000 per person per year for health care. And in Cuba, they spend $251 per person per year. We're going to move on to some of the health indicators to show what Cuba has done as a result of this kind of principles. But I want to elaborate a little more on the history in terms of how they got to where they are today. Because it's a very difficult thing to do, to take a very poor, underdeveloped nation and bring it to a basically first world view on its healthcare system and its approach toward world affairs and economic affairs. So what it did in the first decade after 1960 was to reduce prices, nationalize private facilities, begin to construct hospitals and clinics, and focused on increasing and improving the water supply throughout the nation. They put a heavy emphasis on a rural medical service and first training what they called health responsables, people who were trained, somewhat like the barefoot doctor approach that was used in China, people who would go down to, into the countryside and do basic first aid and training and triage and get people to clinics that were being set up in the rural areas and into the cities. At the same time, they developed the polyclinic system, which was these larger clinics that were based in both regional centers in the city as well as in the countryside that were based on a population or area size as well as the numbers of people in a geographical area. And these polyclinics had primary care physicians, internal medicine physicians, pediatricians, psychologists, surgeons, OBGYN physicians, and pharmacy facilities and some basic laboratory testing facilities. The professional training of physicians and nurses was primarily based on the Soviet model, which was kind of this vertically integrated top-down, the doctor is the one who has control kind of approach. Next slide. So at the end of the first decade, and then moving into the 1970s, they basically, at the community level, through Poder Popular, the People's Assemblies, analyzed what they had done, got feedback from all the people in the nation, and tried to figure out where they needed to go next. And they found that there was significant dissatisfaction from the physician side with hospital-based training, which is kind of the way it is in the United States, and still pretty much predominates that way. And in 1974, they initiated a program called Medicine in the Community, where they promoted a higher reliance on health maintenance and health improvement concepts, and they shifted their teaching focus to the polyclinics, so more of an outpatient community clinic kind of setting. So medical students, nurses, pharmacists, psychology students were getting their training in a broader-based kind of situation. They continued to build hospitals throughout the countryside, both general hospitals and specialty centers, so that now every province, there are 14 provinces, if I remember right, every province has a provincial hospital, which is like a feeder hospital from all the other municipal hospitals for the most difficult cases. And then in various cities throughout the country, Santiago, Santa Clara, Cienfuegos, and Havana, there are various specialty centers, like genetic centers, cardiac centers, cancer centers, diabetes centers, where people from the region and throughout the country can get specialty care. At the same time, Cuba started a biotechnology institute and began producing its own vaccines and medications, and they continued to export diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus vaccines, and meningococcus vaccines throughout Latin America and other third world countries. Next slide. In the third decade, they looked at things again, and they decided to focus even more deeply into communities and develop the family medicine program with a firm emphasis on primary care. What this meant was that they shifted the curriculum in the medical schools and trained all graduating physicians and nurses so that when they were done with their 6 years in training, each one of them would be assigned to live in either a neighborhood or a small geographical region in an infirmary, basically. And they would serve a very small population of up to about 160 to 175 families. So that the physician-to-patient ratio in Cuba now is 100, is one physician for every 175 people. much better than in the United States. By doing this and focusing on the neighborhood region, this is one reason why, for example, the maternal mortality and infant mortality numbers have really decreased, because they really can focus on primary care. So these physicians and nurses can make home visits and check on an infant frequently. For example, a newborn or an infant in the first year of life is seen 30 times a year by Cuban physicians. In the United States, the standard is anywhere between 9 to 12 times per year. So some people say that's a waste of resources, and other people say that's a very good way to disperse and use your resources. So they developed a new curriculum for primary care, and they developed residency training and social service programs that emphasize primary care, and at the same time developed these primary care teams, as I've mentioned. And then for the older physicians, they retrained them so that they were up to speed on these new ideas and could go back in even more deeply into the communities if they wanted, or they stayed in the polyclinics or hospitals. But everybody understood what the principles were and acted on it. And then they continued to develop what's called secondary and tertiary care systems, which are these regional centers of excellence in hospitals and clinics that took care of patients with special problems. Go ahead. Okay, so let's look very quickly at some of their health indicators. And I'm sorry if the numbers, because I'm showing you some numbers, but this is where the details are about how they were successful. This is just comparing Cuba with some other American countries, both Central, North, and South America. And Cuba is outlined in yellow. These are data from 2003. The population is the first column where it says total. Cuba's population is now around 12 million people. The gross national income in 2003 dollars was about $1,100 per year. If you look at the very bottom line, the gross national income in the U.S. was over $37,000 per year. If you look at literacy, comparing Cuba to all these other randomly chosen countries, you can see that their literacy rate is very high, 97%. In 2003, that was people having an eighth grade, the equivalent of an eighth grade education. And in the United States, it's 99%. Next slide. I've already told you some of the health expenditures, and these are old data from 2002, so the numbers have only gone up, although relatively less so for Cuba compared to other countries. Canada now spends about $3,000 per person for health care. We now spend about $7,000 per person, as I mentioned earlier, and Cuba is now $250 per person for health care. Go ahead. Looking at how they were able to change access to water and sanitation, this is UNICEF data from 2004, looking at the year 2003, and water is available in 91% of the country. This is potable water, drinkable water. A little better in the urban areas compared to the rural areas, so they still have work to do there, where 78% of the rural population has potable water. And sanitation means indoor plumbing, right? Indoor toilet is available. Overall, 98% of the population of Cuba now has indoor plumbing. And you can see, compared to other nations randomly chosen in the Americas and the United States at the bottom. So using very limited resources, Cuba very rapidly has been able to improve the basic lifestyle factors that are important to health. Go ahead. This doesn't show up pretty well. This is from our trip, Tina, in 2005, Tina and Juanita, when we were in Santiago de Cuba. And we were just walking out of the Makata Barracks, which was a museum, and I ran into this woman who was carrying her newborn baby, which was just 10 days old, and a health responsable at an infant care center that was right across the street. And so I walked up and just asked this woman, you know, how things were going, what kind of treatment she was getting. She was getting visited several times a week by the health responsable to make sure that her milk supply was coming in, that the baby was growing. If this woman had had a difficult pregnancy, she would be eligible to live in what's called a maternity home. And these maternity homes are available throughout the island of Cuba. Any woman who is deemed to have or felt to have a complicated pregnancy is offered to come live in these homes, where they receive a higher level of nutritional status, nutritional supplies. They receive more intensive medical care, more frequently checked. And they, if they're working at the time that they enter the maternity home, they get paid fully paid leave up through the time they deliver and until they're well enough to return to work. This is available throughout the island in order to assure a healthy, safe pregnancy and delivery. Another factor that has led to a decline in their infant mortality rate. Next slide. So let's look at some of the mortality rates. And look at the middle one, because infant mortality is the one we focus on most to indicate the health of a society. And this is comparing the years 1974 to 2005. And infant mortality is the number of infants who die in the first year of life, those infants per 1,000 births per year. Okay? And you can see the infant mortality in Cuba was just under 39. And in 2005, it was 6.2. It's now 5.8 per 1,000 live births in Cuba. The United States infant mortality is now 7 per 1,000 live births. So Cuba's infant mortality rate has surpassed the United States, and they spend 1/30th the amount of money that we do for healthcare services. Next slide, please. Low birth weight, which is the birth weight of infants less than 2,500 grams, which is a little under 5 pounds. In 1974, just under 12% of infants in Cuba had low birth weight. In 2005, a little over 5% of infants had low birth weight. In the United States, it was 7.9%, or just under 8%. Another significant, improvement in overall health. Let's go quickly, because I need to end so Bill can get his computer back. Could you move on? Breastfeeding is difficult to measure. Only about 40 to 50% of moms are breastfeeding in Cuba, but that's also a pretty good number compared to the rest of the industrialized world. So I don't know if there are any people working with women's programs here. If you have more up-to-date information about women who are breastfeeding in the U.S., I'd like to know it. But these are kind of average numbers throughout the developed and developing world. Next slide. This looks at obesity. And there, just to cut to the chase, the Cubans are quite worried about obesity just as we are. They're seeing more and more of it on the island. It's a high sugar production society. There's a high consumption of sweetened foods. But there has been a very strong campaign to try to reduce this and try to increase exercise programs. Next slide. This is probably the biggest winner in terms of healthcare of children because Cuba manufactures its own vaccines and has now immunized virtually 98 to 100% of people against tuberculosis. DPT stands for diphtheria, pertussis or whooping cough, tetanus, polio, and measles. And you can see compared to other countries, and particularly the U.S., where our immunization rates are lower than Cuba's. And this is really truly a success story. And a couple of years ago, President Bush, when he announced the funding for TVMRT, said that one of the things he was anticipating that would happen when Fidel Castro died and the true Cubans would come back and take over their government was that the health care of the nation would improve and all their children would receive vaccinations. So in response to that, show the next slide. Go ahead. In response to that, this sign still stands. It sits across the street from the American-Cuban intersection in Havana, which says, "Thanks, Mr. Bush, but we're already vaccinated." Next slide. The very busy slide shows how infectious disease rates have changed from 1970 through 2004 in Cuba, so that tuberculosis, diphtheria, pertussis, all these diseases have declined, with the exception of, you can see if you look third from the bottom, syphilis is generally on the rise and then dropping again. Probably the factor for that is that tourism industry was developed significantly in the early 1990s. And with tourism, you bring more people in and out of the country with sexually transmitted diseases, and you have people who work in the tourist industry like pilots and flight attendants who are going back and forth to countries and at risk for bringing in diseases. So the Cubans initiated a very strong preventative health intervention after 1997, and you can see that the rate of syphilis has declined, but it's still not back where it was in 1970. Now, some of these data might be reporting errors, so we don't know how accurate, how true they really are, but the trends are very true. Sorry?
AIDS? It's right in the bottom.
Yeah, AIDS is right in the bottom, and those are provisional data, and if you That has to do, again, with probably the tourism industry and the greater risk of AIDS coming into the country. These data now have changed. If you go to the next slide, comparing Cuba to AIDS and throughout the rest of the Caribbean, it has the lowest rate of infection among adults compared to all these other countries, including the United States. So what Cuba did in the early 1990s was initiate a very rigorous AIDS intervention, actually a quarantine program, which was very controversial, kind of a radical public health measure, where people who had AIDS were brought to live in centers, mainly in Havana, but also throughout the country, where they received higher levels of nutrition, medical care that was more far more intensive, as well as AIDS retrovirus medications. And people were given the option of coming to those or staying in those after a few years of being treated there or returning to the community. And now more and more people who are HIV positive have returned to the community and are back working. But this program was highly controversial and criticized throughout a lot of the world. But it did significantly lower the infection rate in the country. Next slide. Let's skip this because we... And the next slide. Just going to show you some causes of death, and then I'm going to stop, because this is just the point to this is that the causes of death in Cuba are virtually the same of any other... The leading causes of death, rather, are virtually the same of any other developed country. So in the U.S., for example, or European countries, the leading causes of death are diseases of what's called perinatal origin, or diseases around birth. So low birth weight deliveries, extreme prematurity, or infectious diseases associated with prematurity or young infants. And congenital anomalies are second, and influenza and pneumonia is third. In developing nations, the leading cause of death in children less than a year is influenza, pneumonia, and sepsis, which is bacterial infections that go throughout the bloodstream and kill. So Cuba now has a cause of death profile that virtually is a mirror image or the same as all of the developed nations. Next slide. And this just shows the same numbers for children 1 to 4 years of age, and these are comparable to the United States and other developed nations. So that among children 1 to 4 years of age, accidents is a leading cause of death, virtually the same throughout the developed world. Next slide. Keep going. This slide wasn't edited. I'm going to stop because I think we've had enough data, and let me say we can have time for questions, and Bill needs to go. The effects of the embargo have been significant in Cuba. The embargo against trade relations with Cuba allows virtually no medicines that are produced or manufactured by United States companies from coming into Cuba. Any foreign company that has offices in the United States are forbidden from trading with Cuba and sending medicines there. Any medical technology producers like companies that make X-ray products or imaging technique, X-ray machines, MRI scanners, CT scanners, if they have U.S. companies, are not allowed to trade with Cuba, or they face significant fines for doing so. Having said that, Cuba has been able to work around the embargo and work through third nations, different nations, to get the equipment that they need, but at a very high price. So the price they pay in dollars or euros sacrifices their ability to buy other medicines or other things for the society at cheaper rates because they can't get it from the U.S. So buying food, buying medicines, buying technology, buying farm equipment is much more dear compared to if they had trade relations with the United States. And things are actually tighter than ever compared to 40 years ago when the embargo started. So I want to thank you for your attention. I'm sorry if it got too kind of academic, but it looks like you all stuck with it, and let's take some questions.
Didn't get a chance.